As you probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code The Athletic. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic support is brought to you by GameTime, your new go-to app for the best deals on last-minute tickets. Ticket prices drop right before the game starts, and because GameTime tracks prices in real time from thousands of trusted sellers, they're able to show you the best last-minute deals with prices up to 60% off. The GameTime app is simple, quick, and easy to navigate. Download the GameTime app in the Google Play or App Store and score last-minute deals on tickets up to 60% off.
Welcome to The Athletic Support, a special edition of The Athletic Support. I am Marc-Antoine Garin, alongside Arpin Basu. And Arpin, for this special episode, what's the exercise that we're going to do today?
Well, the exercise is that across The Athletic Network, across all sports and all the teams that we cover everywhere, we are looking at the decade of the 2010s and choosing all decade teams for pretty much every team we cover in the network. So, in addition to the Montreal Canadiens, you should look around and go check out all the other all-decade teams. But we have gone through that exercise. Actually, I have gone through that exercise for the Canadiens. And so I wanted to talk to you about it because the take I had, and you're in a very similar spot as me, but in the sense that, you know, the 2010 playoffs, let's say, for me was kind of my arrival on a more permanent basis on the beat. You know, I'd been sort of covering the team on a more part-time basis, I'd say, until then. And so that marked sort of the start of this phase of my career and getting to know some of these players. So going through the decade, I noticed very quickly that the all-decade team is very obvious. There's really no...
For Montreal,
yeah.
For sure,
And if you consider, like, the parameters to be that a player needs to have played a significant number of time in the decade on the team, and performed at a high enough level to be on the team, candidates start dropping like flies, you know?
Right. I mean? So Alexander Radulov, for example, would not have been admissible because he played only one season with
right.
the Canadians.
Not the way I did it. I mean, you could say who were the best players to play for the Canadians over the course of the decade, and Radulov, you can make an argument that Radulov would be on the team, or Weber would be on the team, Shea Weber would be on the team, Brian Gionta. There's all sorts of people, who haven't spent a significant amount of time on the team over the course of the decade, who were good, but the, you know, long-term players who have been here, you basically have six guys, and they very conveniently play six different positions. So it's, it really worked out. So anyhow, I mean, if you haven't read the piece, the team is this. It's Carey Price, no argument there.
Well, hold on a second. Just people, if you are Canadians fans, all right, we had to choose one goalie, two defensemen and three forwards. All right, that's how it came out. So take a second, think who would be those six guys, and all right,
yeah.
Do you have them? They're really easy to find.
Yeah, it really shouldn't be hard.
Okay, let's get going. So Carey Price in net.
Carey Price in net. Obvious choice. 2010 marking his low point of his career in the playoffs.
Yeah,
and he rose from there and dominated the decade like no other player in terms of his performance for the Canadians and his performance. He's, you know, he became the Canadians' superstar player over the course of the decade. No argument there.
Right. In your piece, you took an interesting angle about how it was to cover those guys.
Yeah, and that's why it's great that I'm talking to you about it for this pod, because you also have a similar timeline, I guess, in terms of covering the Canadians.
Yeah, I had started a bit earlier. My debut covering the Canadians was during the Stanley Cup playoffs of 2006. You know, the Justin Williams hitting Saku Koivu's
right.
with a stick in the eye.
Evil Justin Williams.
Yes.
Yeah.
So evil. Oh, my God. Right. One of the best guys in the league,
yes,
actually.
Yes, he is. That series, covering that series was intense, but anyhow.
Oh, yeah. Well, so that was my introduction to covering hockey on a more regular basis. So, but by 2010, when the Canadians played against the Washington Capitals in the first round, that sixth game in Montreal with Yaroslav Halak playing really, he was on his head, and the roof of the Bell Center already.
That's the craziest playoff game I've ever. That's the craziest playoff performance I've covered live. I would say. Yeah.
The noise level was just incredible, and it's
Halak
ironic.
Halak was unconscious. He was not human that night.
Right. So, but it's relevant to say that it marked a low point in Carey Price's career because. Afterwards, I spoke to some veteran players in the season after, and they said, you know what, while Carey Price was on the bench, he became a man.
Yeah.
And distinctively, there's a former defenseman on the team that told me those words, he became a man. And
he's expressed as much himself. I mean, he's said it himself, how watching that playoff run, he made the decision that if this isn't going to work out, it won't be for a lack of hard work.
Right.
That's the call. I'll always remember that quote from Carey Price, said that spring.
Yeah.
Basically, on their getaway day, they said that. So he said that. So, yeah.
Yeah. So it made a it created a change in his work ethic, in the way that he approached the game, probably, and also in his relationship with the media, because afterwards, because he used to be a little bit laid back, not necessarily the most outgoing guy in the first place.
No,
but
he was chill.
But he was chill.
Yeah.
But he got burned on a few occasions, and I think that it really really scarred his relationship with the media. And it's a little bit unfortunate because of all the players that we're going to discuss today, he's probably the one that where his personality, his public personality, or at least with the media and his relationship with the media, is the most different from who he is for real.
Yes. I mean, he is. He's made a concerted decision to be guarded, and because I think he's come to the realization that being chummy with the media only helps the media.
Yeah.
It doesn't really help him in any way. Like, he hasn't seen any evidence that it benefits him in any way. There are some players it does benefit. For example, Josh Georges. Josh Georges was great with the media for years. And when his game started to slip, I think a lot of us were a little later to catch on to it than we might have been had he not been a very pleasant person to cover and talk to, and had he not been so accommodating to the media. I think a lot of...
There's a human factor there.
And you have a tendency to just not want a guy like that to fail. So that's the benefit for a player, to have a good relationship with the media, to be accommodating, might buy you some time when things go south, you know?
Yeah. But not all players will decide that this is a factor, and who cares how I am perceived, who cares how people write or talk about me. Ultimately, this will be my way to handle things, and this is how ultimately my play will speak for myself. And that's...
Yeah,
that's,
but that also the fact that didn't happen for Price.
No.
He was not given extra leash because he was cooperative with the media, because he was early. You're right. Early in his career, he was very cooperative. You could go and talk to him, and he would just be himself. But every time there was a slight glitch in his development or in his performance, he got jumped on.
Yeah.
And pretty fiercely. So I think that changed the way, made it more of a challenge to cover him in many ways.
Yeah. So I got this theory about certain players, the way they talk is the way they play. Like, for example, it's true. Like, Alex Kovalev would fascinate you with some of the stuff he said, but at the same, sometimes you would never know what to expect from him.
Right. He was all over the place.
All over the place.
Yes.
He would take grand detours to arrive to his goal, right? And Scott Gomez was pretty much the same, although he would talk faster in order to do it. And sometimes
and mumble
and would mumble. He would mumble on the ice too. Paul Byron speaks very fast too. Other guys, very calm, very slow. And you look at the way they play on the ice, it's the same thing. Well, Carey Price, well, he answers questions the same way that he stops pucks. You know, you throw a question at him and he's waiting for it. He's ready for it. Yeah. And he'll bounce, the puck will die and right. The question will die. And that's fair. And that's okay. But yeah. I find that that's how it's been. All right, moving on to the D. You could debate that Shea Weber has spent enough time with the Canadians. I mean, he's their captain to be there. But I'll follow along with the two choices you make that are perfectly justifiable. First one, let's start with Andrei Markov.
Let's start with Andrei Markov. So this starts, you know, if you read the piece, and I hope you do, but if you read the piece, this is the first of my three Who Boys. Who boy in terms of covering Andrei Markov. Now, Andrei Markov, I will say, you know, he was a difficult guy to get to know, not only for the media, but I think many of his teammates as well. You know, they all had sort of this seemingly like this kind of this distant respect for his work ethic. And you always heard these mythical stories of Andrei Markov in the gym.
Yeah.
You never heard a teammate talk about this time when they went for dinner with Markov and they told this great joke and whatever. Like, it's not like, that's not part of the legend of Andrei Markov. So, you know, and I think a few members of the media here, you know, made the effort to try to get to know him and actually built somewhat of a rapport with him. I'm not one of them. I don't think you are either. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I had a couple of stories.
Couple of run-ins.
I'll finish it.
Well, I would say that it's more reflective of me as a reporter that I did not make the effort to try to get to know him, just because it seemed like it didn't seem like it was something he was interested in, and I just took that for granted, and I kind of regret that now. That I didn't get to know him better because he's one of the best players in team history. I mean, he's really one of the most impactful players this team has ever had in the modern context that the Canadiens are not a dynasty and whatever. But you look at his track record, his length of time playing here, you know, more so than his games, the number of years he was the best defenseman on the Canadiens.
And he made, you know, that saying.
And he's an incredible player.
Making people around him better, that's who he was.
That's what he did.
Ask Mike Komisarek.
Yeah, no, ask, there's tons of people. That's Sheldon Surrey. I mean, just the number of guys that he made a ton of money for, it's a long list. Mark Streit.
Yeah.
Lots of guys. So anyhow, I didn't really have a take on covering Markov because I didn't really have an experience covering Markov other than watching him play. And I loved watching him play. I thought he was a, a very entertaining player to watch, and I really enjoyed getting that opportunity.
Right. Well, I had a few run-ins with Mark Goff over time. I remember when he came back from his second knee surgery. Mm-hmm. Second surgery to the same knee, by the way, which is right. Which was rather unusual.
I was in the Mr. Markov era.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Mr. Markov from the famous Pierre Gauthier. So I went to see Justin Williams again, who had dealt with the same thing, although Williams had not had surgery on the same knee twice in the span of 1 year like Markov had. So I went to see him, Williams, and asked him, you know, how it was and all that. And he went on very generously to discuss the medical aspect of it and saying, well, you can, the first time you can use a tendon from your patella or from your hamstring and have it like used to reconnect the ACL. But once that is done, he thought personally, I thought it was too invasive because you would have to heal another part of your body at the same time. Just wanted to focus on my knee. So the other way to do it is to use a tendon out of a cadaver.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I went cadaver both times, and he was so forthcoming discussing it. So after that, with that knowledge, I went to Markov and say, so this time around, Markov, did you use a tendon from your own body, or you went cadaver? And he looked at me like he had guns in his eyes, and I think he said something like, are you a doctor? So, and that was, I never got an answer for that.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, that could be, you know, trying to understand the experience of it. Maybe that Markov could be more open about that. And oh my God, he wasn't. And I remember also his last season in Montreal, we were on the road. And by that time, everybody, you know, he had been there for so long, and his nickname was Marky, very original.
Of course,
nickname,
yeah.
Marky. Everybody called him Marky, the PRs, and obviously the players, the right. coaches. He was Marky, except for Pierre Gauthier calling him Mr. Markov. And so I went to see him, and I said, can I ask you a question, Marky? And he said, my name is Andre. Okay. He says, Marky's for my teammates. So it was hard because on certain days you could approach him and he could be nice, and you thought you had, okay, I made, there's a breakthrough there. There might be something going on here. And then you come the day after, you come back and you try to be all, you know, just
casual. Trying to be casual, yeah.
But I felt that there was, obviously he let me know that there was a line that I had crossed by calling him Marky, and I did not have the right to do that. Yeah. So
this is why I never call players by their nicknames.
Yeah,
this is my policy, and this is a strict policy that I have for this very reason.
Yeah,
well, that one day this is going to happen.
Yeah, well, it happened to me. It happened with the guys that you would expect the most to happen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, another debatable figure, another old boy type of guy,
polarizing figure. Yes.
Yeah. No. Let me see. A polarizing figure on the blue line. Something tells me that it's not David Schlemko.
No. And polarizing figure on the blue line, playing right defense, who won a spot on this team over the current right defenseman who is the captain of the team.
Yeah. So it's you. Let's refer again to those playoffs in 2010. What an arrival.
What an entrance for P.K. Subban. That was, I think incredible.
I think, you know, he stole the hearts of the fan. He became a fan favorite instantly. And when you have a moment that people are so engaged into playoffs like the ones in 2010, and you have a guy who was antagonizing
Sidney Crosby.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we didn't know at the time.
Playing close to 30 minutes a night.
He played close to 30 minutes in one game in that Pittsburgh series.
Yeah.
Where Jacques Martin just decided, whatever, I don't care. We need something. We need a spark. We need this kid. We're going to ride this guy. Because you got to remember, Andre Markov had gotten hurt. A lot of his other defense were banged up. Jaroslav Spacek was banged up, was playing through a bunch of stuff. And like there were issues on that blue line. And he had mostly held him back, you know, giving him spot minutes here and there, sheltering him a bit. But in that game, he just let him loose. And that was, you know, PK was matched up with Sid quite often in that game and was giving it to him.
Yeah.
And I think you know, it created, it set the stage for his time in Montreal that he's a, that he's a showman, and he can be, you know, outwardly outlandish at times, but, when there's a big game, that's a guy you wanted on your team.
Absolutely.
He really did. Maybe for a whole bunch of other games, maybe he could push it a little bit, but when chips are down, you wanted that guy on your team.
For sure, because he could sure talk the talk, but he would walk the walk too.
He would
back it up, yeah. You know? So it's, and he was spectacular to watch. I think that's, when you got a guy that's so entertaining, even though sometimes the risk versus the reward is not always at an optimal level, it was so much fun to watch him. And, and when I saw him the other night at the Bell Center wearing the New Jersey Devils jersey, you can tell how the Montreal fans benefited from his best years, because we don't see that sort of play, that quite the same jump that he had before.
And so covering him was interesting. I mean, you really had to learn how to filter PK Subban and pull out the nuggets of truth that would slip into just a whole bunch of empty calorie words, you know? He's the type of guy where you ask him a question and he'll just start answering it immediately, almost before you're finished asking the question, with the first things that come to his head. And whether that's actually relevant to the question or not is irrelevant to him most of the time, because he just starts talking and he thinks as he talks. And so you gotta know that, yeah, you have PK Subban talking for a minute and a half, and he said a whole bunch of stuff, but when you actually go back and listen to it, you realize he really didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And it's on you to cut him off at the pass when he starts going off on a tangent, and focus him on your question.
You mean that he holds on to the puck for too long? There you go.
Your theory proven again. I mean, I'll just give one, we'll go quickly, but one example of that with PK. So after he was traded, I was working at the NHL at the time, so I was covering the Winter Classic in St. Louis and went to Nashville for the Canadiens' first game in Nashville right after New Year's Day. So,
yep.
You know, early January of that year. And so there was a press conference after the morning skate that day. And PK shows up. He's got like this really fancy leather jacket that he let it be known to myself and a few others that it's from a Montreal designer. This was his name, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, he comes out and he sort of sees all the crowd in the room and was like, ooh, look at all these people. He was excited that there was a big press conference for him. And I remember, if you remember the Shea Weber's first year, the Canadiens got off to a really, really hot start. They won like, I don't know off the top, but they won a lot of games, 10 out of the first 12 games or something like that. And Nashville didn't. And so by the time January came around, Nashville had picked it up. The Canadiens had cooled down, obviously, but they were still both competitive teams, you know? So I asked PK, what was it like for him to watch at the beginning of the season, not knowing how it was going to go in Nashville, to watch his old team thriving without him? How did that make him feel? And he starts talking about, I think that year the Columbus Blue Jackets went on a ridiculous streak of some sort. Like they won like 12 or 13 games in a row or something like that. So he started talking about the Columbus Blue Jackets and their streak and how teams go on streaks. And he basically said, kept talking about that. And I was like, PK, I had to cut him off on a press conference and say, PK, you never played for the Columbus Blue Jackets. I didn't ask you about the Columbus Blue Jackets. I asked you about the Canadiens, a team you played for your entire career until now. Oh, right. Yeah. And then he answered the question. And the people in Nashville were stunned that I cut him off.
Yeah.
And afterwards they're like, man, you totally interrupted him. I'm like, cause he wasn't answering the question. And like, so that's how you have to do that. I'm like, yeah, that's what you have to do.
Right. Over the years, I mean, for people on TV looking for clips on TV, on radio, you were using the expression empty calories. That's what they were fed. And luckily for the writers, you can discuss and have an exchange and all that. And that's when you could really, mince those words.
You get to the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
You get to the truth.
But it needed some pushing to get rid of the veneer of PR that was. And I think
you could get there with him. I mean, you really could. When he was like being sincere and just relaxed and not putting on the front, the PK Subban show element there was to him.
Yeah.
Just talking without cameras and without microphones. He was great to talk to about hockey. He helped me a lot in learning the different systems that, especially under Jacques Martin, early in his career, he would go into depth, and even Therrien, I would have systems conversations with him all the time, and they were, they were very insightful and very helpful to me as a reporter, because now I could go and watch it play out, and it was often exactly how he described. So he was very helpful in that way, and super, super nice and accommodating, and seemed to genuinely enjoy that part of his job. I don't know how much he does now, but at the time he did.
Yeah, he did. I think things started to change at some point when he considered how to organize his brand off the ice. I think it was the beginning of this last season in Montreal when he launched a website, and he was available for interviews, and he had a big thing about launching a website, which is something that, happens every day everywhere, launching new websites. So what's the big deal? So, but I sat down with him, and he started telling me about the fact that he had a brand manager, and that he had, so that's around the time that he had a logo started, and it really...
And that was the conflict, that was the start of the conflict with the Canadiens, because he wasn't allowed to wear that logo.
Right.
In interviews.
Yeah.
The Canadiens have a policy that you can only wear team-branded apparel in interviews. And that was one of many little mini conflicts that he had with the organization.
Right. So it had, by then, I mean, obviously the relationship with his teammates at Elred always been on walking on a very thin line, and it was on the eve of collapsing. But that whole off the ice aspect and the business aspect of his branding really took over, and I think it carried it followed him to Nashville and now to New Jersey. But it only heightened, I think, if I can interpret the way that the behavior of his teammates in the years that he, in the last few years of his tenure in Montreal, you had the sensation that he was bigger than the team, or he talked in a way that made him bigger than the team.
Well, that was definitely the way it was. That was the problem.
Yeah.
That was the perceived problem, whether it was true or not. I don't know if he saw it that way. I think the team saw it that way. But let's move on. But that's what it was. It was challenge cover. Like, the main thing about him is that if he was talking, you felt like you could not afford to miss. He might say something.
Oh, yeah.
And if you miss it, you're screwed as a reporter. So when he spoke, and that also created a distraction in the room, in the sense that whenever he was speaking to the media, it created this huge rush. People would literally leave interviews in the middle of the interview to go talk to him.
Right.
And there's nothing more rude than ditching a player to go talk to another player.
Yeah.
Is the worst thing you could do as a reporter. And reporters did it with him all the time.
Right.
Like, all the time. So that became problematic as well.
Let's move on to the polar opposite of PK Subban. A guy who probably dissolved himself into the concept of a team. And within his teammates, so much so that he didn't have much of media presence, and that's centerman Tomáš Plekanec.
Yes, is the opposite of PK Subban. Who, and it's funny though, but he's always insisted that he got along famously with PK, and it actually really liked him,
mm-hmm.
even though there was this perception. I think they fought once in practice. And he was seen on when they had that sort of behind the scenes show,
yeah,
a couple of times needling him and whatever. But he always insisted to me that they had a great relationship. But Tomáš Plekanec, polar opposite. And so I mean, Tomáš very well, as do I. You would see him from time to time in the dressing room, never really enthusiastic about about conducting interviews, let's say, but always willing to chat.
Yeah.
Enjoyed chatting. Interviews, not so much, but chatting with Tomáš Plekanec was another guy who I could talk about systems and, you know, particularly penalty kill and situations and game situations. I could ask him about a situation in a game that happened 3 weeks earlier and give him the score and the time and the period, and he would know exactly who was on the ice, he would know exactly what happened, and he would know exactly the decision that was made that was either right or wrong, and could break it down for you off the top of his head. It was incredible to watch. So, yeah, didn't get enough recognition, I feel, over this time in the NHL. The fact that he was never a Selke finalist bothers me. I don't think it bothers him, but it bothers me, and I think, but he acknowledged at least that his lack of a public persona or his reluctance to participate in that game, might have contributed to that, because the Selke is a very reputation-based award, so you do need the media talking about you being a good defensive forward in order to be considered so that reporters in other cities start noticing and what have you. And he never did that. He's not an artificial guy, you know?
No, for sure. No. And Plekanec was, really a coach's player. You know, you got, he's the type of guy that would, always, show himself to be reliable for the rest of his team, for his coaches. But at the same time, in terms of the public view, I think that he suffered a little bit from the same thing that Saku Koivu had suffered before, and to a certain extent that Philip Dano is living now, and that's the fact that the Canadians not having, like, that true bona fide number one center, you need someone to fill that role. And I think that Saku Koivu, in the hopes of a lot of the fans, maybe through obviously the drama and even so the tragedy that he suffered, through that he might have felt short of the expectations of becoming that bona fide number one center. But Plekanec tiptoed into that role, but was given to him mainly by default, but that doesn't take anything from the way that he was playing. And sometimes I think the proof is in the pudding when you look at the playoff results, where people say, "Oh, but Tomáš Plekanec was not a playoff performer," but he was playing like a number two center, doing exactly his job, exactly what he needed to do in the playoffs to contain the other team.
Yeah.
But that would not necessarily come with a whole lot of points because of what he had to do to contain the other team. But there was just nobody else to provide the points if he did not.
But I think the important thing to remember about him is that he sincerely did not care about his playoff criticism, because he felt very proud of the way he performed in the playoffs and knew that the criticism he was getting was based on a very shallow analysis of goals and assists and games played, without looking in any deep way whatsoever. You just have to look at that 2010 playoff run. I mean, you know, in every elimination game the Canadiens played in the first two rounds, Ovechkin, Backstrom in the first round and Crosby in the second round didn't do anything, really, anything of consequence at least. It's largely because of him. So, a real pleasure to cover that guy. I really had a soft spot for him. I really enjoyed sort of working with him, if you will. And he's still playing.
He's still playing, yeah.
I'd like to go watch him play over there one day.
He's in Brno.
Yes.
Yeah. And, but you could argue that his best years, though, were slightly before the 2010s, before that decade, because around 2008, 2009.
Well, that was his career year, that year. He had 70 points that season in the regular season.
2010?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And then, but a few years before that, when he centered Kovalev and Kostitsyn and you know, that Guy Carboneau-fueled power play team, that team that was actually quite average except for having an extraordinary power play. That was him at his best, I think, you know, like feeding Kovalev and providing sort of the defensive presence on that line.
Right. Okay, on the wing.
Left wing. Yeah.
Max Pacioretty. My God.
Again, unarguable in terms of numbers, is the franchise leader over the decade in goals, points. I think he's third in assists. He, you know, is was a complicated person to cover, to say the least. But you can't argue with the results he had over his time in Montreal.
No, because, I mean, he was – obviously, he was not Ovechkin. He was not Steven Stamkos. But he was right there in the conversation with guys like Corey Perry or Joe Pavelski when he came to production. And he did it in an environment where he didn't have a whole lot of a supporting cast. And he did it on some seasons where the team was just not very good. And I thought that it's a guy who – he's a guy who always put so much pressure on himself that it was a kiss of death to name him captain because as a goal scorer, usually the mindset of a goal scorer is, I need to help this team by scoring goals, and that's how we're going to win. And it's busy enough in a goal scorer's head to – have that pressure, deal with that pressure, and make sure that you deliver anyway, that to give him that second mandate of being the captain and show the example, being there for your teammates, answering questions to the media, being the connection to the coach and so many other tasks when you're a captain, it was just too much for that guy.
It was. And it was too much for him because he cared too much. Like, he was really – it's not – you can't slight him for it because he really – he cared too much. He was obsessive over it.
You know?
Like, he was like, so, but covering him was great because he was very available. He would push back on a question if he didn't think that it was appropriate or whatever. Was very accommodating over his time and, you know, I'm kind of happy. He's in a perfect place now in terms of, he plays in a market that actually does like hockey and does like the team, but it's not going to smother you and it's going to allow him to, I guess, unobsess a little bit and just go out and play. So
yeah, it might have been overwhelming. Montreal has been overwhelming at times for him, but I think when you have a guy that shows his emotions as much as him and really, you know, it's a heart on his sleeves. Heart on his sleeves, is that the expression?
That is the expression, yes.
Yeah. I think you...
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's the expression.
No, and it's rather disgusting when you think of it. But that's really who he was, and obviously it makes for more compelling discussions, compelling coverage also than when you have guys that truly take their craft to heart and that they're able to express it to, because
yeah.
I don't doubt that, you know, almost all of those hockey players down there in the locker room, they love hockey, they love their job, but those who express the highs and lows as much as he did, it's always a bonus.
Yeah. And he was great to deal with. So the final one is at right wing is Brendan Gallagher, who was drafted in 2010 in the fifth round. So basically arrived in the organization, has spent the entire decade in the organization, and arrived in Montreal during the lockout shortened season of 2012-13. You know, numbers wise, can't really argue otherwise. I mean, Brian Gionta would be the only other guy at right wing I would consider.
Yeah.
And coverage wise, I mean, it's just there's not a whole lot to say about it, just because he's just a nice guy. Like, he's just a guy who understands this part of his job, because I think in part because he broke in and lived with Josh Georges and watched him operate on this side of things, and sort of took the lead from him. But you know, always a stand up guy and always willing to provide that insight on aspects of the game that you might not understand or that you're trying to decipher. Very helpful.
Yeah. Some guys that are – there are some guys that choose not to make it an issue. You know, the relationship with the media, they'll be available, and they just brush it off.
Yeah.
And it becomes second nature, and they – without saying that they would embrace it, they come to a point where it doesn't matter. And it's the same with Philippe Danault, a couple of other guys, and I'm sure, but it's not everybody, and I'm sure that some players that must have asked Gallagher over time, how do you do it, you know?
Right.
But for him, it hasn't been an issue, and it makes playing in Montreal so much easier because I know that we as a brethren, we can be a burden sometimes.
We can, because we're trying to, we're competing, but we're also in, you know, we're a big pack of people. And so there's always, you know, Brendan Gallagher deals with about 8 waves of interviews. There's the original scrum. Then there's always like one person who wants to get him alone and another person wants to get him alone. And another person, and he never loses patience. He never like gets sick of it. And
yeah,
he just gets it. And so,
or if he does, it doesn't show.
It does. Yeah. He might curse us all as soon as he leaves the room, but he doesn't let it show. So that's it. That's the all-decade Canadiens team.
I'm going to add just on the ice, Brendan Gallagher. I hope that this is the year where he's going to be named for the All-Star team. It's more than, you know, it's more than due, and I think that it's about time.
Stupid format that yeah. will prevent. The only thing that prevented him last year was the format. They needed a goalie.
Exactly, and so. they might need a goalie again. You know,
yeah.
And the Canadiens, yeah, and it's. But why limit the Canadiens at only one representative? It's sort of been the format over time. But if for some, and in any way, if he could manage to sneak his way through the All-Star game, I think it would be a nice recognition because he deserved it.
I agree. I think he would really enjoy it. You know, that's, I remember covering, the All-Star game in LA, and that was Michel Therrien's first All-Star game. And the look on his face when he was there, he was just taking it all in. He felt like he had achieved something. Like, this is the first time in his career that he was an All-Star coach. And I can't help but feel like if Brendan was in that environment, that he would have the same kind of look on his face.
Right.
Yeah. So so we'll recap, the all-decade team for the Canadiens. Carey Price in goal, Markov, Subban on defense, Pacioretty, Plekanec, Gallagher up front. That's it. And a big reason why the Canadiens had a kind of middling decade is that there really aren't any other candidates to make this team. And so the problem has been that they have not had a depth of players who have excelled over an extended period of time. For the last 10 years. And yeah. That's kind of where they find themselves where they are. But now, with players that they've drafted and they're starting to develop, they might actually create that in the next decade. So we'll see.
We'll see you in 10 years. Bye-bye, everybody.